Right now, we have Drew McDermott, an AI researcher who wandered in by mistake, or some other reason. Professor at Yale University, I've known a long time. It's a pleasure to introduce him, and I'm looking forward to his talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, I guess that'll make up for the fact that I don't expect to be applauded at the end of the talk. So, one of the main things about this talk is I have to convince you what I'm talking about is difficult, and after I've convinced you of that, you'll be wondering why it's worth doing. So I hope to also talk about that. So, all right, I'm talking about the problem of maintaining the coherence of a running Lisp. So, unlike other languages, of course, once you get a Lisp started, you tend to leave it running for a while. So, the question is, how long is a while? And I have a sort of compulsion to keep it going as long as possible. That is, the idea of just restarting it just because it broke in some mysterious way is really annoying. So, in my opinion, it should keep running until the system crashes for some other reason. So that raises all sorts of issues. For example, you want to avoid memory leaks. I know people say that can't happen in Lisp, but you can do things like set a global variable to some huge structure and then you forget about it. And that's a memory leak, in my opinion. It happens all the time. So I've got special ways of avoiding that. I don't ever set fresh variables in the loop, in the listener, and so on. So the problem I'm talking about now is the problem of coherence. And so an example of incoherence is where you create a table in one file, and you put a few entries into it, and then in a later file or other files, you add entries to that table, and if you're in the middle of debugging, you go back and you load the first file, and all of a sudden all the entries that you had later have been lost. And the symptom of this is usually not obvious till at some later point something mysteriously fails to happen because a handler that was supposed to be in the table wasn't found. And I've had bugs like this that just bothered me for a very long time. So, let me do a demo here. So this is my Lisp image, and I have 3,500 lines here. I don't know how long it's been running, but it's a few days. I really don't want to have to restart it or anything. So here's a typical problem. Okay, so here's the file where I create this table, only I've made it into a really simple case. The table has two entries, and it's a vector, and the table's called AB, AB star, and so when I initialize it, the first entry is called started, and the second is called incomplete. And then, of course, in the subsequent file, I add I change the element, the second element of the table, to be the add and finish. So, so if I do something like this, if I say please load those two files, it loads them and compiles them, and ABAB star is now set correctly to the array started, finished. All right. So sometimes later I decide that there's a bug in that first guy and I want to redo it. So I didn't really mean started, I meant begun. And so I load I'll say demo one again, and now AB star is incomplete. So, of course, we all have little workarounds for this. We have little scripts that enable us to get things back into certain states and all that sort of thing. But here's what I really want to do. I want to say, what I really want to do is to wrap a piece of macro around it saying, def file segment, call it ABAB, and the file segment means this is a little chunk of information that, when it's run, puts the computer into a certain state. And then in the other file, I will now say def file segment, a different segment called ABAB finish, which depends on ABAB. That's the second argument there. And what this means is that whenever I want to update this thing here, whenever I want this to happen, it should happen after the first thing has happened, when the first thing changes, this should change, and so on. Okay? And so, let's see if we can get that to happen. Okay, and I'm doing the same sequence of events that I did before. The god of demos is against me here. I played with this ad infinitum earlier.
Well, it's simply that's what you would like to know.
The problem is that even the first one's not working.
Well, that's okay, we're in fun.
I don't believe I'm going to have to restart this to get it to happen.
That would
be really cruel. Looks like I am.
Oh God.
I've never given a talk in which I wasn't deleted by the machine. So. Okay, just pretend all that didn't happen. Okay, and now if I do this thing again, and it better work, or I'm wrong now. Now I'm going to set it to be begun. Okay, applause, please. So, as you can see, what happened is that it sets at the beginning complete, but then the other guy says, oh, I need to update myself, and so it runs again. All right, now, okay. Now, as I said, I have to convince you that this is difficult and it's worth doing. Maybe you have a belief that it's worth doing, but I'm sure you're convinced it's not difficult, because this is really... this looks like very standard spreadsheet technology or something like that. Okay. So, back to the slideshow. All right, so the basic idea then is obvious, that we have this idea of a chunk, and a chunk is a piece of information or a piece of information in a particular place or a piece of information in a particular state. Okay, typically chunks will be associated with declarative sentences. So, as you'll see, I'll label these things with a sentence saying something like, the BASL file so-and-so is the up-to-date compiled version of the list file so-and-so. The leaked chunks, the ones that aren't derived from something else, tend to have noun phrases like the file 1.list, or something like that. Okay? There's an implicit conjunction here that this requires both of those to be up to date before this can be updated. Okay, so we call these the bases, C2 and C1 are the bases of C3, and C3 is the derivee of those two. Okay? And so the terminology, the word derive, I use as a neutral term for a generic function that, when applied to a chunk, brings it up to date. So it's called deriving it. And the The method for that is called its deriver. Okay? So, that's, everybody could do this. I'm sure it's not a problem. Obviously, the graph is acyclic. I'm not talking about any place where you have to, you know, go through some fixed point computation. Okay. So, just said all this. Piece of information, or piece of information in the state, is a chunk. Generic function derived brings the chunk up to date. The derivation graph is acyclic. And chunks are, this is a, so an application issue. Chunks are, you're supposed to picture something big. These are not spreadsheet cells, not little things. Even though my example there wasn't very little. But these are big things that are happening over the span of seconds, minutes, or hours that the changes occur. It really is for the purpose of keeping things in a coherent state. Okay, so why is it difficult? there are three main reasons why it's difficult. One is that the basis relationship can be disjunctive. There can be more than one chunk from which a higher chunk can be derived. Now, that might strike you as being unlikely, but I will explain that. Some bases are needed not because logically they are part of the foundation of some other chunk, but because they're needed in order for the other chunk to be updated. I'll give you an example of that. And finally, this is a kind of one that the principle really can't solve, but it's absolutely crucial to deal with in some sense. That is that chunk derivers can all do the chunk network. So it's not, there's no way to avoid that, I should say. Okay. I'll say a chunk is managed if the system is committed to keeping it up to date. And this is something the user tells the system. So, obviously, once we've created a chunk, we'd like to have a mechanism later saying you could stop thinking about that chunk. So I'll just use the terminology management. So you request that it be managed, and you terminate management, and you can shift it back and forth between those two. Okay. Now, so here's an example of why we have a disjunctive basis. Okay. So LM1 is the chunk. The macros of file1.list are loaded. As I said, chunks are characterized by declarative sentences. Now, there are two ways you can achieve that. One is you can slurp the file. This is a technical term for going through the file and extracting information that you need. And so you can go through the file, get out its macros, and of course the function for macros call, that sort of thing. Or you can just load the file. Now, most people wouldn't even think of doing this. That is, people simply load files. People in the Lisp community are willing to load and reload and reload. And you know, if you're a compiler, you usually load the program you're trying to compile gets loaded in before you compile it and all this stuff. I hate that. It's just not clean. You should be able to say, I need this information, and that's it. I want to be precise about the information I need in order to build something. So, I don't know if you want to share that mindset or not, but that's an important factor for me. So, I will not just put by a knee-jerk reaction load a file if I don't have to. I'll go through it, perhaps, and extract such stuff. Now, this is a disjunctive relationship, and this disjunctive is marked as the default with the double-headed arrow there, because if I have no reason to load the file, I won't load it. I'll just go get the macros out of it. On the other hand, there's some independent reason to load the file, and so I've already loaded it, and it's up to date. In other words, this declarative sentence is true and up to date, then I don't need to do that. Okay, so that's the basic idea. You load the disjunct if you have no other reason to load one of the, I'm sorry, you load the default if you have no other reason to load another disjunct. Okay? And this means that SM1 should be managed if L1 isn't. If there's a reason to manage L1, there's no reason to manage SN1, at least not under rival this piece of the graph. Now, next complexity is the notion of a derivation basis or derived basis. In order to compile a file 2 and make this declarative statement true, there are three things you have to worry about. First of all, you need to update this if file 2 changes. So this chunk influences that chunk. let's say that it depends on macros defined in file 1. So if these macros have changed their definition, you should recompile the file. Okay? But if you have to recompile it, then in addition, you have to load the macros in. Okay? Don't need to load the macros in if they're up to date. In other words, this logical relationship just says if the macros haven't changed since the last time you compiled, then this provides no reason to recompile. You don't have to load it to tell that. You can just look at the file write date. But if you do decide to recompile for some reason, say this file changes, then you have to load the macros in. So we use a double-headed white arrow to indicate something's part of the derived basis or something else. Okay? So you put this network together with the other network. This is then to figure out the complicated. All right, now the third factor, and the one that's really the worst in some sense, is chunks can change the chunk network. And why is this? Well, my standard example is the Y-Tools file manager. I have a set of, tools called Y-Tools available from Clock and also from my website. A lot of the systems just various macros that I think are nice, like I have a good loop macro instead of a really awful loop macro that's the standard. And an important part of this is what I call the Y-Tools file manager, YTFM. It sounds like it's a really great acronym for something. But it isn't, it just means Y-Tools file manager. So the way I handle file dependencies is I'll write in each file the files that it depends on, rather than supply some external system definition. This seems to be like the right way to do it. Okay? So how do you tell what the chunk network is for the files? I've shown some networks. How do those come into being? They come into being by scanning files and extracting this kind of information. Okay? So when I extract it, this means that if this part of the system is driven by the chunk mechanism, which it is, then it can change another part of the chunk mechanism. Now, of course, in this case, there's kind of a meta relationship between the chunk network that figures out the topology of the other chunk network. That's kind of essential. Otherwise, everything would get would be kind of meaningless. But still, it's something we have to deal with. Okay. All right. So this leads to the development of two algorithms, which are somewhat intertwined, but basically independent. Algorithm one is the one that decides what should be managed and unmanaged. So the user puts in requests saying, please manage this, and the system updates the management flags to decide what should be managed or not. Okay? Now, this is an absolute trivial algorithm normally, because the rule is that if you're managed, then all of your bases should be managed. Right? If you want this chunk to be up to date, then you better make sure that its precursors are up to date. And if you decide to terminate the management of the chunk, and there's no other reason to manage its bases, then they should be unmanaged. So that's an easy algorithm, except for the possibility of cycles. Now, there shouldn't be any cycles in a basically graph. But there is one case. That's the one raised by the disjunctive situation here. The problem is that this, as I said before, D here is managed if C is not managed. Okay, and this means that if you're propagating along, let's suppose that you erase the last reason to manage C, then that becomes a reason to manage D. So that guy becomes managed. I should have been turning blue, but I forgot to do that. I have other effects, but not turning blue. Okay, so let's suppose somebody inserts this relationship. It says, by the way, C is a basis of of D, right? That is, the management of D is a sufficient reason to manage C. So C is managed if D is, but D is managed if C isn't. So that means we get a contradiction. Okay. So this structure and a slight generalization of it are verboten. We could obviously iterate this around and make odd length or even length cycles of the sort, but they are. They cause problems. How do you deal with this? Well, the solution is you simply detect this and stop until the user can't have this. And I explain in the paper there's no good reason I can think of ever to have this. So we believe that if you detect a cycle like this, it's a bug. Okay? All right. Algorithm 2 then is the heart of the system. It's the chunks update algorithm. And the idea is that the application programmer runs along creating chunks, labeling things as chunks, indicating what their relationships are, and after editing or say reading in a new file, it then says, it calls chunks update to say now propagate the effects of this change to the network. So again, this is a graph propagation algorithm, not terribly novel. You might wonder exactly what the scope of it is, but it's pretty broad. It basically scans from the chunks explicitly mentioned down to all their leaves, all the leaf chunks that support them, and it scans forward to all the derivees and derivees that you can find, and makes a decision whether to run them, and then runs them in the correct order. Okay, it's a little tricky. There's a lot of premature optimization that in this case is not premature, because you can, if you just do a depth first traversal of these graphs, as you know, there's this well-known exponentiality that will bite you, and it really is necessary to deal with it, even in version zero of the algorithm, but dealt with that. However, there's a lot of other complexities. As I said, those double-headed white arrows mean that a chunk has to be managed if another chunk has to be updated. Okay, so it has to be temporarily managed. So this means that in the midst of algorithm 2, chunks update, you have to call the management algorithm. Okay? Second, if a chunk update occurs, it's triggered by something we do. So if we, loading a file is a primitive operation as far as the chunk system is concerned. That is, to update the chunk, file 1 is loaded, you load file 1. That's a huge amount of computation, and you have no idea what's happening. It just happens. And so it's quite easy for that to cause chunk update to be called under the radar of the main call. We'd sort of like to be that when you call chunks update, no other updating is happening at the same time, so we can't have that. A file can be loaded, or a header of a file can be scanned, something can happen. And so what we have to do is we have to detect when the chunk update, when a rogue chunk update has occurred when we're looking. If that happens, we just restart the current one because the network may have changed and so on. And so we really can't preserve what we've done so far. There's one caveat. The caveat is that in the course of the given call the chunks update, we never call derive on the same chunk twice. The idea is the user's code can fiddle with the chunk network all at once, but if it happens to fiddle with it after the derive has been called, then derivation is not going to happen on this call, chunks update. Okay? This is sufficient to make sure that the thing will halt unless some busy beaver is making new chunks at about the same rate that you're consuming them, and so you can easily cause it to go in the loop, but in practice that doesn't happen. This is fairly large things like files being compiled and so on. Nobody's out there just making files. But this kind of possibility, it's hard to say what would mean for the system to be correct. We can sort of guarantee that it's locally consistent, that everybody's up to date in some sense, but correctness is quite hard to define. Okay. So, conclusions. This YTFM system goes back a long way. It was originally, the original code, I think, was written by Chris Riesbeck, who was at Yale in the 80s, Northwestern. So we were playing with this code for, you know, reading headers of file and decide headers of files from which to decide what to load. And the system has evolved, to put it lightly, over the last 20 years, and it kept misfiring, doing the wrong thing. It was just extremely annoying. So I finally rethought the chunk system from scratch and then re-implemented the file manager in terms of it. So now I'm confident that it works. It actually has the right feel to it. It has to do the right thing when I'm watching it go. It's very gratifying. The system has a lot of tools. I mean, there are a lot of things that surprised me. I didn't realize when I started writing it that this update basis was going to be an issue, and it was what it was. But it seems like right now it has enough features that I can implement what I want. So that's good. There's a lot of interesting things to explore here. Why is it that a file depends on a file? Isn't that too coarse-grained? It's better to say a segment of a file depends on a segment of a file, like I did in the demo. Okay. So there's a lot more stuff to explore here. The thing is available, well, not right this minute for the laptop fans, but you can download the YTools, but the old version, 1.something, does not use the chunk system. The new one, it's getting to be stable enough that I'm pretty sure people can use it without blowing up in their faces, so it should be available fairly soon under the rubric YTools 2.0. Okay? So that's it. Thank you. Questions?
So in the example you gave, if you have a file and the set of macros in that file, and you know, to compile the file, obviously you need the macros that it uses. And it sort of sounds like you have something that goes through and extracts just the macros, but actually the vowels don't. I mean, you're using the macros.
Yeah.
So the fact that you need to do that why not just make your life easier and put the macros in a file and have the dependencies between, you know, the stuff that you're extracting is essentially a separate.
The reason for slurping originally and still is the fact that I want strong typing in Lisp. So I have a macro package that does strong typing. So this means if you have a file full of functions, it also has some type definitions perhaps, and then a bunch of functions, you have to go through that file and extract the type definitions before you compile it. Okay, it's especially true because I like to write the calling function before the subroutine in my file. So somebody has to look ahead and see what the type of that guy is before he compiles the calling function. Okay, so I need a two-pass compiler. So the slurp mechanism evolved from that, but it has a million and one other uses. And so in that case, I can't say load this file before I load this file. Right? I've got to go through it and do something less strong than loading before I can load it. Well, that's the list speaking. Basically, yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about how slurp works?
How slurp works?
Yeah, because in general, distinguishing what functions the macros depend upon or what state update.
You have to explicitly declare that a function is needed by macros. There's a little thing you put around saying needed by macros. There's also the eval quin slurp top level that I've added.
get state updates.
So you can declare things. Yeah. There's actually more than one kind of slurping, so there's some stuff to share, but often it's sufficient to just say any kind of slurping I would like to evaluate this one. Yeah.
Does it run for ACLs, Control C, Control X?
Control C, Control F?
Control C, Control X.
You compile?
That's S expression, compile S expression, compile H.
I use those. I do use Allegro. But I don't. I mean, that's a good question. It's like if somebody took my example of declaring a file segment, you'd have to be careful not to go into the middle of it and evaluate something. You'd have to be aware of it if you want the whole chunk. So yeah, you'd have to be careful about that.
using big chunks, is that mostly just a keep that computation down, or is it?
Why are they big?
Yeah. I mean, or is it just that it's hard given you have to sort of manually wire them together?
A couple things. One is that I didn't worry about cost overhead. For example, if you're writing a spreadsheet or a database, you might start thinking about the details of the data structures, and that really is not an issue here. Another is, this is going to sound silly, but I need to know when something was derived, so every chunk has a date when it was last derived. So what time do you use? Well, the default is universal time, but that only measures down to a second. So it'd be really wrong for spreadsheets, but for file operations, it's about right. I could fix that, but it just meant certain design decisions that I could just ignore some performance issues, basically. Yeah.
Is there any connection with truth maintenance systems or non-monotonic logic or other forms of logic at a foundational level between your work?
I think there was, given that I work on that stuff, but I think years of therapy allowed me to suppress the relevant memory. it did occur to me that some of these things are vaguely reminiscent of reason maintenance systems and like that, but it's going to be simpler, I think.